my lips. No new taxes.
I'll make our government open and transparent, so that anyone can ensure that our business is the people's business.
I remember landing under sniper fire. There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles.
I will close Guantanamo. I will restore habeas corpus.
You're listening to Part of the Problem on the Gas Digital Network.
I can be the freest country in the world when you lock more of your own people in cages than any other country in the world.
The lesson of 9/11 should have been to never fund another young rebel group in this part of the world again.
America started as the smallest government in history, and it's become the biggest government in world history.
At the end of the day, it's all about freedom.
Here's your host, Dave Smith.
Oh, hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. I am Dave Smith. I'm joined, as always, by Mike Brancatelli.
Hello.
And I'm very excited for this episode. We've got a great guest Skyping in to start things off for us, making his return appearance here on the show. And we loved having him on last time. You might know him. He's the director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, also the co-host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report. Daniel McAdams, thank you so much for coming back on the program, sir. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me back on.
I'm very happy to have you back on because I think you're someone who helps me understand the complicated mess that's going on within the empire and the warfare state. You and Dr. Paul do a great job of kind of shining light through some of these very, very confusing times that we live in. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about was, I mean, as I was reading the paper this morning, I don't even think it was in my paper. That's how new it was today. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump announced the replacement for his national policy advisor. Am I saying that position right? What's it called? National Security Advisor. National Security Advisor, excuse me. And it's this guy McMasters. Now, I don't know much about this guy. Do you? What are your thoughts on this selection?
Yeah, well, you know, he's not as high profile as some of the people that he was considering for the job. You know, you think about people like John Bolton, whose name was being bandied about. And before that, Elliot Abrams was considered for the second job Deputy Secretary of State. But his name has still been floating around a while, and a few others. So he's not as high up there on the radar screen. But he's most known, really, during the Iraq War, for being one of the guys in charge of the counterinsurgency philosophy, or COIN, is what he was known for. So that, you know, that is, depending on how you feel about how the counterinsurgency went in Iraq, might give you some clue as to how you feel about McMaster. But as a matter of fact, Dr. Paul just called me. He was out for his afternoon walk. And we talked a little bit about it, and he said, well, it's not as bad as it could have been.
Well, he's absolutely right about that. I mean, I think even as you said the name Bolton, it sends a chill up my spine. And I was a little bit relieved once I saw his name being floated out again that we at least it seems to be that Donald Trump is putting some people in there who are at least somewhat skeptical of this kind of neocon globalist, we need to fight one more war after another in the Middle East. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to be a non-interventionist by any stretch of the imagination. And I think there is some concern about how Trump has really turned to top military officers in so many high-ranking positions, including Homeland Security with General Kelly. So that whole instinct to go to top military people is slightly alarming. But at the same note, he doesn't have the reputation of someone like a Michael Flynn as being someone, you know, completely obsessed with Iran, and also prone to being to saying some things that are pretty unusual, as you know, things that have been attributed to Flynn, pretty unusual, and also a lot of news about Flynn about abusing the staff and forcing them to come up with crazy conspiracies like that Iran was behind Benghazi, so. There doesn't seem to be a lot of that in McMaster. And, right. You know, I'm spending the afternoon trying to get to know him a little better. And you may be familiar with Kelly Vlahos, who writes for the American Conservative. And she did some great work a while ago on the counterinsurgency doctrine. And I went back and looked a lot of her old articles, and she didn't write a lot about him. So he clearly was not out in the forefront, even in that whole sort of movement.
Right. Now, just to help some of my listeners understand this more, this counterinsurgency doctrine, this to me, from my understanding, is like the original neocon position was that we were going to go into Iraq with a what they called a light footprint. It would be what they described as a slam, or they said it was a slam dunk that they had weapons of mass destruction. What I meant to say was it was described as that it would be a cakewalk, was their term. And their prediction was that democracy would spread around the region as a result, as we would be greeted as liberators. They had all of this, just all of these predictions that did not come true. And then it seemed like after all of those failed, they moved into this next phase, which is what you're talking about, which is that kind of after that they had this surge, and then they bragged that this was very successful, right? So could you? So what exactly is this philosophy that we need to just up the troop levels everywhere, and then we can squash out violence across the Middle East?
Well, that's part of it, and you know, David Petraeus really sort of made his name also in the counterinsurgency doctrine. If I were to boil it down to sort of grotesque simplicity. What it was is, as you point out, after the so-called surge, it was essentially the U.S. paying the Sunnis to stop attacking us. You know, we basically rented a Sunni, and we rented a jihadist or a militant, and just to let them stop attacking us as much. And it's sold as more of a civilian component to the military occupation and this sort of thing. But essentially it was, you know, rent a militant. And when we stopped paying the checks, we asked the Iraqi government, we said, we're giving you a ton of money. Will you guys start paying the checks for these people? And, of course, they just pocketed the money. And that's when things started going to hell in a handbasket, you know, in the late 2000s in Iraq. So it was the next best thing. It was the next big thing. And from what many people have written, it has not been a spectacular success.
Yeah, I would recommend for anybody who wants to read more on this. I thought Lou Rockwell had a fantastic chapter on some of these topics in his it was like 2 books ago. What was it called? Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto. And
yeah.
What was that? I forget the
against
heading.
The state?
Thank you, Mike. It was Against the State and Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto. And he has a chapter about how the military actually becomes like a full-fledged socialist government in the countries that they overtake. So they're just handing out basically money for everybody to do the job of security. And so anyway, very interesting stuff. So I just wanted to ask you more about, because you touched on a little bit on Michael Flynn. Obviously, there were scary things about him, but I think you would agree that what's equally troubling is the manner in which he was kind of ousted by the deep state, if you will. I guess the silver lining is that I have never heard so many people in the public talking about the deep state as I had over the last few weeks. But what did you think about that whole situation with the NSA spying on him and then him getting kicked out? Pretty crazy turn of events.
It was, and it really played off of the anti-Russia hysteria that's overtaken Washington. I mean, I would guess that even in the height of the McCarthyite 50s, there wasn't this level of hysteria that Putin is, you know, personally behind everything that goes wrong in America. It's almost laughable, and it's hard to believe that otherwise intelligent people are signing on to this. But I guess, you know, you look for a crutch, you don't want to face your shortcomings. But, you know, I think in a way, I mean, Flynn, you're right, is not a good guy, and people like Phil Giraldi have written about a lot of his shortcomings. But the manner in which he was kicked out was surprising and shocking. And I think actually Trump did himself no favors by accepting the resignation as he did, because it really adds fuel to the fire of those, particularly the neocons and those in the Democratic Party who've joined forces really to say, see, there was something there. There you have it. There's something he's trying to hide, and he got rid of him. So he was kind of damned if he did and damned if he didn't. And I guess he chose the path of getting rid of him. But it was pretty amazing to see how quickly he was taken out.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think you're spot on when you say that this Russia hysteria is what allowed this to happen, or at least allowed there to not be more of a backlash against this. What exactly is your take on what's going on with all this Russia hysteria? I find it very interesting that that the two, from my perspective, I guess would be the two really establishment candidates this year, which was Marco Rubio on the right and Hillary Clinton on the Democrats. And they were both advocating this no-fly zone, this crazy aggressive posture against Russia. Barack Obama's kicking diplomats out. The media's going absolutely nuts about Russia. No one seems to have actually presented any tangible evidence of what they did that is so unprecedented or so crazy. What is it that they are so afraid of with Trump having a less hostile posture toward Russia, from your perspective?
And what's frustrating is there is so much to criticize Trump on. Pick out something that's real rather than something that's imagined.
Yes.
And you know what else the American mainstream media is not reporting, and I'm sure you guys have seen this, that WikiLeaks came out with a document showing how the CIA had infiltrated the French political parties in advance of the 2012 elections. So, and this is hard evidence, you know. So unlike all of the crazy theories, conspiracy theories about what Russia did in the U.S. election, and by the way, nobody contests that the information released was inauthentic. So it was real news that was released, the Petraeus emails and such. Well, everyone is crazy about this. That's unproven. Here we have proven information that the U.S. was involved in fixing the French elections, and the mainstream media just yawns at it. It has no interest whatsoever in any of this.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I would take the Russian thing, and Dr. Paul and I touched on a little bit in the show today, but if you turn back the dial to 2014 and the coup in Ukraine, that's when it all started. And it's been such an incredible windfall for Washington, D.C., if you think about it. A whole cottage industry has been developed on this hysteria over the U.S. coup, U.S.-backed coup in Ukraine, to put Poroshenko in power and get rid of the elected Yanukovych. It's been a godsend to the military-industrial complex, to all the think tanks, to all the pundits, to have somebody to beat up on, and it's really been something amazing to watch.
It's very strange to me because throughout my life, I mean, they've sold a lot of, you know, a lot of propaganda to encourage conflicts that were just unnecessary, or the what they were selling it on turned out to be lies. But this particular conflict with Russia, I mean, there's like almost nothing there. I can't get over that they're able to sell people on this fear that Donald Trump could be friendly with Russia, and then we could maybe fight ISIS together and not have a war against Russia. Like, what is the big – even when I hear John McCain talking about this, you know, it used to be like there's going to be a mushroom cloud, you know, from Saddam Hussein or some terrorist. That no one seems to be saying that. Putin hasn't really demonstrated any aggressiveness in that sense. Do you see what is the fear?
Well, the real danger is that – I mean, I think for us, which is what I'm mostly concerned about, is it stifles debate. You know, back in the early 2000s, when the neocons wanted to go to war with Iraq, and people like Dr. Paul spoke up and said it's not a good idea, you know, they were accused of being a Saddam lover and, you know, oh, you just love Saddam Hussein. The same thing when it was Gaddafi. But nobody really believed that anyone like Dr. Paul or any opponent to the war was really a stooge of Saddam or of Gaddafi. And nobody really believed it. But with Putin, it's different. Somehow it sticks, and I think it's probably the decades of Cold War propaganda, this residual image of the Soviets, the Soviet Union. So it can actually really damage people's reputation when they're thought of as being soft on Russia, you know. And it's dangerous, and it's a way of getting people out of the debate who really should have a place at the table. So it's very concerning, I think.
All right. So overall, big picture with the the victory of Donald Trump, and now that you've gotten a sense of, I mean, a little bit now that he's been in there for a month, what's your sense on where this guy's foreign policy might go? I know I saw before we started recording, Mike was talking to you about your episode of the Liberty Report today. You guys were talking a lot about him posturing his posture in Syria. That's pretty concerning to me. I know Flynn's out now, but still his posture toward Iran is pretty concerning to me because I know there's a whole bunch of neocons still permeating the Republican Party who want nothing more than a conflict with Iran. Again, another one I don't understand, but they've been itching for that war for almost a decade now. What do you think? Is there anything, you know, some libertarians saw some hope in Donald Trump. certainly there was an argument Hillary Clinton was about as hopeless as anyone. So I could kind of see that during the campaign. But at this point, what do you see happening in the next year or the next few years? Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I thought it was pretty funny during the show today because, you know, Dr. Paul has been a pretty strong critic of Trump from day one and consistently so. You know, he struggles to find things to be positive and compliment him on, but overall very critical. And he said, you know, what frightens me the most is it seems like on foreign policy, Trump is the most sane and most restrained person in his cabinet, you know, which, that, you know, is pretty frightening. But yeah, you know, we talked today a little bit about the executive order that Trump issued, I think, on the 24th, telling Secretary of Defense Mattis that he has 30 days to come up with a plan to defeat ISIS. And the question is, you know, is this going to include a military escalation? And, you know, Trump did a stop in Florida over the weekend in Melbourne, Florida, where he said, we're going to have safe zones and the Gulf states are going to pay for them. You know, it's like a recycled line from the border wall on the Mexicans. But you know, if this is his plan to have safe zones, to have a U.S. invasion, this would be a significant escalation. And really, people that follow it more closely will have to scratch their heads because, if anything, you can say things in Syria are dying down a little bit. They're getting a little bit better. Aleppo was liberated from al-Qaeda. And despite what everyone said, it's actually getting back to normal. People are cleaning up and rebuilding. There aren't any massacres, although the media won't report that. ISIS is losing ground every day. They're losing their sources of income. They're encircled. They're losing territory up near the northwest, near the Turkish border, and even out in Raqqa. Things are going well. So why on earth would you want to put a bunch of, you know, several thousand U.S. troops in the middle of this when, by the way, the U.S. wasn't even part of the negotiations leading to the December ceasefire? It actually progressed just fine with us staying out of it. So maybe that's a hint. Things will get better if we just stay out of it.
Well, you know, what was very strange to me about that was that while all of this just, you know, horrible civil war, there's been, I mean, very, very large numbers of casualties over there. All of this is going on. The media is kind of, you know, not going crazy about it. Then as Assad forces take over Aleppo and the ceasefire is in, then they start going crazy. It seems like they almost don't want things to calm down if Assad is still going to be in power. It's very good. It seems to me, I don't know what your take on this is, but it seems to me like all of these war-hungry Republicans, they talk about ISIS a little bit, but when it comes down to it, it seems like what they really care about is getting Assad out of power. That always seems to be more important to them, from my perspective at least. I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, they're very invested in the idea of regime change as a matter of national policy, and they've tried it. They've had some minor failures with much smaller fish. You know, they tried several times to get rid of Lukashenko in Belarus, but compared to Syria, that's a pretty small kettle of fish indeed. So getting rid of Syria was the first plan, and this is not conspiracy theory. They've written about this in the open. This, you know, after Iraq comes Syria, then comes Iran. This is the plan to remake the Middle East. And so the failure of the regime change plan for Syria would put a serious monkey wrench in the works for their big grand strategy for the Middle East. And I think that's why they can't let go of it. And they're convincing Donald Trump that we've got to go into Raqqa, we've got to take ISIS out of Raqqa. And when in reality, what the neocons, what the interventionists want is to turn eastern Syria into sort of a breakaway province, and to sort of be able to control the rebel attacks from there. They don't want to let go of this, even though it at least at this point it looks as if they've lost.
You know, one of the points that Dr. Paul used to make quite often when he was going after the neocons was, you know, he would just point out that they all had their, or not all, I should say, but a large number of the neocon intellectuals had their intellectual roots in like Trotskyite communism. And yeah, it is very strange to me that they all, there is something very, still to this day, similar to the communist philosophy, where they really do kind of feel like they've got to break some eggs to make an omelet, and they've got this grand design for how they're going to remake civilizations. And, you know, if you know, a few million people got to get murdered here, a few million displaced here, a nation destroyed here, well, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. And then, of course, much like communism, at the end, we don't get an omelet. We just get more of a disaster than we had before.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, sometimes I have hope in Trump because he seems to get it. You know, he gave a speech a couple of weeks ago. It was the inauguration speech where he says, you know, we have to recognize that every country, you know, follows its own national interest, and we shouldn't expect all the countries of the world to adopt our exact system. And I'm paraphrasing it, but those are themes that he's explored several times in his campaign, and I think those themes have resonated well with the American people. But the neocons do not believe in that. They believe in a universalist, philosophy. And it is, you're right, it is, it does, it's certainly a lot of them intellectually, maybe not this generation, but a generation before, not Bill Kristol, but his father Irving Moore, were very, very much steeped in Trotskyism and the idea of a permanent revolution. And it is sort of, if you think about it, it is more of the dialectic. A permanent revolution is a sort of a, is an implementation of the dialectics where you move forward continuously, you'll have setbacks, but you, and then you reach your synthesis and you continue to move forward. And that's why, you know, when someone like Trump comes along who messes up the process, I think that's why both sides have gone nuts, the mainstream Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know if you heard Trump's or saw Trump's interview with Bill O'Reilly during the Super Bowl, but he made a comment. We talked about it here on the show that I thought was pretty amazing when Bill O'Reilly said that he said Putin's a killer.
And
Trump said, you know, we got a lot of killers on our side too. And then it was very, very, I mean, you know, it's in a dark way. I'm laughing. I know this is quite tragic. I don't mean to downplay it, but Bill O'Reilly actually goes, well, we don't have killers. I mean, we make mistakes.
Yeah.
As if somehow, you know, like those people in Iraq who are dead, you don't need to worry about that. That's just a mistake. And I was sitting there thinking to myself, you know, besides your partner, Ron Paul, I've never heard anybody else who was a major candidate for president actually bring up how many people get killed over there. He did it once on the campaign trail as well when he was talking about Hillary being trigger happy and how many Iraqis and Syrians had died as a result of our foreign policy. So I do agree with you. It's at least nice that he inserts that into the public discourse.
Yeah, it reminded me of Michael Corleone when he was talking to his fiance Diane Keaton, you remember? And she said, who's being naive here? You know, and it was sort of like that moment, a very dark moment. But yeah, if you have this messianic view of America's role in history, this sort of this view that somehow we are the new Israel and we must impose our will on the rest of the world, it's such a frightening philosophy. But if you carry that philosophy, then you think that we can do no wrong because ultimately we're pursuing the greater good. And I guess for religious people, it would have those sorts of purposes. For secular people, it would be the ultimate in governance or what have you. But it's still a very dangerous place to base your philosophy on, I think.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. I wanted to ask you, because, you know, it's been an interesting – for me, it's been somewhat disheartening over the last few years. You know, with Ron Paul's campaigns in 2008 and then 2012 – I felt like there was a lot of momentum in the liberty movement, that we really had the young people, particularly on the right wing. The young people were really all leaning libertarian. If you looked at YouTube videos, all the comments were about Ron Paul and Ed the Fed and end wars. And now this kind of alt-right Trump movement has come in, and the more comments I see are about kind of build the wall and how Muslims are just inherently radical. And it seems like we've lost a little bit of our hold on you know, the some of the people coming up or the next generation. I've heard Dr. Paul talk about this before, and it kind of bummed me out when I heard him talking about Bernie Sanders, and he went, man, you know, there was this one clip, it was months back in the campaign, where he was saying, man, if I had thought that we'd be flirting with a socialist now after I thought Americans were rejecting government finally. Do you get an impression from him? Is he disheartened by any of what's happened in the last couple of years? The fact that there hasn't been more of a libertarian movement that a lot of people, even the New York Times, were speculating might be coming? What's your thoughts on that or the opinion you've got from him?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think we saw this a lot with the Tea Party movement, you know, which really was initiated after Dr. Paul's campaign. It was based on a Tea Party that his campaign supporters, grassroots supporters, put on to start a movement, and it was, you know, it was quickly hijacked really by some pretty establishment types. And it was remolded. You know, all of a sudden, the non-interventionist foreign policy sounded a lot more neoconish, you know. And so I think you see a lot of that, and I think it is disheartening. I have never seen the libertarian movement as divided as it has been by the Trump phenomenon, you know, with, I'm sure, people that we both admire on either side of the of the fence on it. And it can be disheartening. And Dr. Paul and I, we do talk about this a lot because it's a difficult topic. But, you know, his view is that we have to stick with the philosophy, you know, and in troubled times, we have to continue to push the philosophy. And, you know, he's been critical of Trump, but he tries to find areas that he can be, you know, just as he did with Obama, you know, the Iran deal, the opening to Cuba, when he does something right, you know, to recognize that. And it's but he's actually quite optimistic. And I know that because we talk about it a lot. He thinks that this is one of the greatest opportunities ever for us to push the philosophy, because a lot of people were excited by Trump. A lot of Ron Paul voters were excited by Trump. And they will be disappointed to some degree or the other. And they will at that point start looking around, hey, maybe it's not the person. Maybe it's not the movement. Maybe there's a philosophy that we need to return to. And I think that's where he's most optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, that's nice to hear. And I try to remind myself sometimes when I feel pessimistic that so many of my heroes, people like Ron Paul, were just for decades voices in the wilderness that really nobody was listening to, who were still preaching the message, and they just kind of kept on at it. I mean, really, nobody cared about Murray Rothbard or Ron Paul or a lot of these guys for years and years. And then eventually, when the time came, they looked at Ron Paul and were like, oh man, this guy's been saying this basically his whole career and been pretty consistent. So I try to remind people, you know, to be consistent now so that they'll be ready for that moment later. Let me, before I let you go, I want to ask you a couple questions that I get a lot from listeners, and I'm wondering, where do you end up getting a lot of your news from? Like, how much does a guy like yourself read the mainstream media, and what other news sources, like, do you go to every day to stay informed?
Well, I read constantly. I probably read too much, I guess. But, you know, I always have sort of a pattern in the morning. I don't read a lot of the mainstream media. I don't go to it, you know, intentionally. But, you know, I always will look at Target Liberty, Bob Wenzel's site. I always look at what Lou Rockwell has up. I always look at Zero Hedge. I'm sure a lot of people have the same pattern. Mm-hmm. For international news, I turn to RT.com because they have a lot of interesting stuff. They have a spin on some things, but they have a lot of topics, and it's very interesting. And then, to be honest, I spend a lot of time on Twitter too, because Twitter is like your own personal intelligence service. You can rejigger the knobs, and you can get some of this and some of that. If something's happening in Yemen, you can start following some different sites. And so it really is, that is a remarkable, for all of its faults, it's a remarkable technology if you want to try to look for alternative views. So it's there's a lot out there. And of course, I like to read antiwar.com as well. You know, that's pretty much the pattern, I guess.
We love those guys over at antiwar.com. Oh, also shout out to the Libertarian Institute that Scott Horton and some of those other guys that went out there. Cool. No, absolutely. All great stuff right there. All right. I guess let me ask you one final question before I let you go. What do you think, if we were to talk about the future of the Liberty Movement or the future of the anti-war movement, maybe more specifically, do you think... maybe one of the silver linings that I try to hold on to is that under George W. Bush, there was a little bit more of a nice anti-war movement. And now that the person in charge of the war has an R next to their name, maybe we can get a little bit more of that going. Do you think maybe we can get, we have the longest wars in American history. Under Obama, there was basically no backlash to him. Do you think maybe we can be optimistic that there'll be a little bit more backlash under Trump?
Well, I think there are principled progressives that are, for example, Dennis Kucinich, who's on the board of the Ron Paul Institute, has always been very principled, has taken a lot of heat. We're very excited about Tulsi Gabbard, who's absolutely fearless. You know, she's faced down her own party, she's faced down the neocons, and she just doesn't give a crap. You know, she's great, and I hope she continues. But, you know, we do ponder these things. As a matter of fact, if I can make a shameless plug, if you don't mind.
Please do.
We're joining together with the Mises Institute, and we're putting on a symposium actually down here in Lake Jackson called War and Peace in the Age of Trump. And that's going to be on April 8th. With you can get info on the Mises.org website. But we've got a great lineup of people. David Stockman, who's a former rep, who's, you know, a hardcore libertarian on foreign policy, Austrian economics. Eric Margolies, who's one of my favorite international affairs writers, is going to be there. So we've got a great lineup to talk about what to expect in the next in the coming period. And so, yeah, we think those same thoughts. What's going to happen? So we're going to try to hash it out here in April.
Okay, that is an all-star lineup. Very exciting for a lot
Rockwell.
Of our listeners know those guys very well. So that should be very cool. We'll definitely keep our eyes out for that. I look forward to seeing that on YouTube. Mr. McAdams, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to come chat with us. I'd love to do it again soon. Keep up the good work. Guys, if you don't already, go watch the Liberty Report on YouTube. It's one of the best libertarian shows out on the internet. Go support the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Daniel, thanks so much. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
All right. Good to have Daniel back on the show. Mike Brank.
Yeah.
What do you think?
No, it's great. Yeah. And I like what he said at the end, too, about, you know, I was just thinking about that recently. You know, Tulsi Gabbard, she's this progressive, you know, a Democrat, and Dennis Kucinich. And, you know, we've been talking about messaging and communicating and, you know, not really giving up on people on the left and stuff like that. So,
yep.
You know, I think this, you know, the anti-war message, you know, can unify people, and hopefully, you know, that will be something that kind of takes off, and we can maybe, you know, see an end to this, like, perpetual war and invasion and, you know, intervention and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it would be nice to have that, so we can then focus on, you know, libertarian, building a libertarian world. You know, that would be pretty nice.
No, I agree. Yeah. And I love hearing, you know, the stuff that...
I'm optimistic.
Of course, so, yes. Yeah. But I love hearing the stuff Ron Paul said. It was very, you know, he was saying that, Dr. Paul was saying, you know, just you got to stick with the message in hard times.
That's right.
You stick with this
That's
message.
Right.
You don't abandon it.
Right.
And, you know, I couldn't
And
that
means
more.
Working across aisles, you know? That means working across aisles. That means not, you know, shouting down people just because that you disagree with them. It means, you know, standing together, unified with them. And, you know, standing together, they're unified with people that you don't agree with, but you find one common thing to fight for and fight against. And I think, you know, that has to do with being putting your priorities in order as well. And yeah, I mean, like, I love to hear that Ron Paul is, like, optimistic like that. And Ron and Daniel, both tremendous. I mean, they're talking about waking up at 6 a.m., 7 a.m., getting to work, reading all this stuff, getting prepared. That show that they do, The Liberty Report, is a daily show every day, and it's where I get a lot of my information from as well. So
yeah, it really is excellent. And you know, still at his age, Ron Paul is just so on point, man. And yeah,
it's
our dream.
Yeah.
Get him on the show one day. That's a dream.
Yeah, yeah. It's inspiring.
Yes, sure is. All right, so moving along, all types of craziness going on. I don't know what where to start with this one. All right, let's start with Milo and what happened when he was on Real Time, and now what's happening to him in the media, because I find this story very interesting, and we were talking about it a little bit on the last episode. So Milo, right? Like, it seems like step one with Milo was to try to shut him down. Then you had people like Jeremy Scahill boycotting, as we discussed last week.
Unbelievable, yeah. Scahill.
Yeah, really just Scahill. Yes, really just, you know, disappointing. Hard to put it in any other way, in any other terms than disappointing. Anyway, Milo did end up going on. So he ended up going on. He had the opening segment with Bill Maher, which we're not going to play any of, but, you know, it's up online if you guys want to go check it out. But I'm going to play some of the roundtable he was on afterwards. So at first they had him. Here's the other thing, is when Jeremy Scahill was like, oh, he's opening up, so I won't even have an opportunity to debate him. He ended up bringing him back on, you know, for the last segment, where you did have an opportunity to go back and forth with him. Unfortunately, Jeremy Scahill wasn't there, and he tangled with a couple dummies. Anyway, I thought, you know, obviously there's major issues that I disagree with Milo on, and major issues that I disagree with Bill Maher on. But overall, I gotta say, I kind of had the feeling like, yeah, they both did a fairly good job for what the situation was. I know a lot of people on the left, it's so silly, were furious at Bill Maher, because they're like, you know, it's like this thing where they're like, you should destroy him. You should have just destroyed him. And I, you know, can somewhat relate to that situation, where I've had a few lefties on and had some of our listeners angry at me. There's, oh, you should have let him have it, or let her have it, or whatever. And you're like, you know, it's a little, first off, when you have someone on your show, you want to be respectful. And second off, when you have limited time, especially like they do on Real Mar, it's like, you know, they're talking for 7 minutes. how destroyed is anyone going to get? But anyway, Bill Maher and him, you know, kind of respectfully disagreed on a few issues, agreed on a few others. And then Bill Maher, you know, turned to the audience at one point and said, is this what you're so scared of, liberals? Like, yeah. This little fairy?
He goes, this impish British fag. Yeah. That's who you're scared of?
Yeah. And so anyway, I gave Bill Maher credit for that. And so then he has him on over to the desk. Now, I got to say, I found this really interesting that so many people thought Milo was being a dick. And I really thought look, Milo is Milo.
He is.
I thought Milo came on kind of jovial,
yeah.
Was kind of friendly. Bill Maher was kind of jovial, kind of friendly. And then these guys were, I just want to say, Larry Wilmore and this CIA hack were outrageously immature and insulting. This is what I thought. A lot of other people were like, because Larry ends up, you know, cursing him out, basically, is what happens. And a lot of people were like, yeah, well, it's because he called him low IQ. But if you look at what happens, they actually start getting very petty and insulting with him first. So anyway, let's play a little bit of this clip. They talk for a little bit. This is Milo at the round table on Real Maher with Bill on Real Time with Bill Maher. On Real Maher with Bill Time.
Right. Well, let's start with you, Milo. Why did you single out a transgender student for ridicule during a recent speech you made on her campus? Did you do that?
Well, yes. First of all, wasn't a student. He had already left the university. And I make no apologies for protecting women and children who are confused about their sexual identity.
Well, I'm confused about who this is because pronouns are so important. If you call Caitlyn Jenner he, you're a bad person. So
yeah,
this
I
is
did
a,
it on purpose.
You did. So this is a man
I misgendered
yeah, right.
this person.
Right.
He's
so
paused
this
for
is
a second.
Man, born
it's
man.
So funny already that this is the boogeyman.
That's what
this
I'm saying.
This is the boogeyman
right,
that they're
yeah.
all so scared of. He's like, you misgendered. This is really
how
what
they're
like.
You.
Oh, my God. Shut him down.
Yeah, a man in pearls.
We can have free speech, but not someone who misgenders.
Right.
I mean, this is Nazi shit right here. You know, that's what the Nazis did, right? They misgendered. I love these corrections already, and so many of these things with these outrage stories happen this way, where it starts like, you harassed a student. And then they go, no, not a student, an ex-student. And you're like, oh, we're talking about like a 25-year-old here. This is like, oh, okay, this is an adult who entered a debate or a conversation or whatever. All right, let's keep playing. Sorry.
Who thinks that he might be a girl.
Okay.
And
you have a problem with that?
No, I don't have a problem with it, but I think that women and girls should be protected from having men who are confused about their sexual identities in their bathrooms.
That's not unreasonable.
That person yeah. who was an activist who took their own university to court to force his way into the female locker rooms had already left college by the time I gave that speech, and that was totally misreported by the press, just like they misreport everything else.
Jack, where do you stand on weirdos, Pete?
Well, it sounds like
guys, gotta respect Bill Maher.
People weirdos,
just to fuck with him.
That's really rude.
I think you two are doing a great job with this topic. I'm going to keep going with it.
Yeah. I don't really know anything. I'm just the pop star.
I just think it's sad because the same arguments that we use against gay people, treating them like aliens who just wanted to fuck anything that moved, and that's why we should avoid them at all costs.
No, I think there's a big difference.
Well, let me finish my thought, please. Sure.
So you can pause it here. So you can see there's already just a lot of that. It's a lot of like kind of like playing to the audience of like, look, I understand someone's talking over you, but he's not going like, let me just finish. It's like, let me finish my point. Okay. So now, and you just see a lot of, now what happens here, I'll tell you, there's something about Bill Maher's crowd. I've talked about this before because we've been breaking down Bill Maher's show a little bit lately. There's something about Bill Maher's crowd. And what I respect about Bill Maher more than anything else is that he gets it and hates it too. Like where he'll just say something and then they go, yeah. And he's like, shut up.
Yeah.
Like he'll tell them. He's like, stop. I'm not just here. But what it does is it makes these other guys who are not used to performing in front of crowds like this, like live audiences necessarily. I mean, Wilmore, I shouldn't say.
He looked like nervous though.
He should be used to this, I should say. But the CIA guy, not so much. Yeah. But what happens is they get it when you start getting – the audience actually makes you worse because it makes these people start just going for the cheap applause lines. It's a good feeling to hit a big applause line. Feels nice. Everyone in the place is clapping for you and you're going, it's you versus this other guy. And then you're like, I just won because everyone agrees with me. So then, as you see, they start kind of playing for this applause. But anyways, the more – the basic basic point that Larry Wilmore's hanging on to here that he thinks is a brilliant point is that society used to say gays were a disorder, and you're kind of making it out like transgender is a disorder. Again, there's really not that strong of a point there. At the end of the day, you'd go like, just because we got one disorder wrong doesn't mean we got every disorder wrong. And then you go like, what led to these being considered not disorders? Was it political pressure or actual science? Anyway, let's let Larry finish his point, and things start to get a little tense.
There's a difference without a distinction, because it's using the same type of arguments. It's like when people try to compare gay and black. Yeah, they're not the same thing. No. We share an invisibility. You know, people didn't see us in society, and gay people hid out from society. Mm-hmm. Right. But there were a lot of the same issues that you have to deal with when you're marginalized.
We understand and now people that, can be discriminated
against.
Well,
no, that's a group
reasons,
that's
right?
marginalized, and so the attack. You can always find an extreme person that becomes the object of your attack to assign that to everybody. So if you say, well, that person is weird or they want to commit sexual assault, then everybody thinks all transgender people want to do is commit sexual assault.
Well, they are disproportionately involved in those kinds of crimes.
They're what?
Vastly disproportionately involved in sex crime.
Who is?
Gender people?
Yes!
Based on what statistic?
That's not a controversial statistic.
And it is a controversial statistic.
And frankly, you know, you're saying, you know, you're suggesting these people are the victims of some kind of discrimination. Well, I'm saying to you, this is a psychiatric disorder.
I didn't say discrimination.
This is a psychiatric disorder.
I said marginalism.
Identity disorder, or like sociopathy or something. You know, I don't want these people around little girls in Boston.
Here's what I said. The same argument we used against gay people. You should do your homework because
it was wrong then. It's right now. That's perfectly
reasonable. No. Homosexuality was called a disorder. It was a psychological disorder.
Maybe it is. I feel pretty disordered.
Well, maybe you are.
Maybe it is.
But most homosexuals are not.
You know what?
No, I think most gays.
Do you not? Do you see what I'm saying there? When he goes, well, most are not. And he's just kind of like waiting for that applause to hit. It's like you get a little lazy because you're like, why are you laughing? You didn't say anything funny. You said, well, maybe you're like that, but most aren't. Mm-hmm. And then he's kind of looking around for, like, you make this dumb line and you're looking around for, like, some type of, like, you know, I don't know, like, reinforcement on it. And anyway, I don't know. Milo's arguing that maybe homosexuality is a disorder. He's flamingly gay. I don't know how you can take this as like a hateful argument, but this is maybe he's wrong. Maybe he's not. Your argument can't just be. So Larry Wilmore's like, you're wrong. You're wrong. Most gays aren't. Okay, let's see where we go from here. Let's let the guy from the CIA weigh in.
Long road, actually. Most gays have a long road to coming to terms with their sexuality, and
yeah, because all of them end because up of the happy way society treats them.
No, of course it isn't. Don't be ridiculous.
No, of course it's the way society treats them. If society said we're fine with gay people and it's 1890, you think in 1990 people are going to have
issues? You're being very obtuse. If I can't produce a child with a person I love,
yes.
If I can't produce a child,
all I know is this. I have one quick question. I'm not a journalist, and I may just be an old spy, but you were talking about confusion. Were we talking about you?
What?
Because you sound very confused. You were talking about people being confused about.
Dude, I mean, this was painfully cringeworthy. He literally, this motherfucker is, first off, he works for the CIA. He's been sitting there silent while this heated debate comes on. And this is his moment to chime in. He goes, hey, remember before when you said people are confused? Maybe we're talking about you. It literally was a jerk store response.
Yeah.
From this CIA guy. I couldn't even believe it. And it's just, and he goes, we're talking about you. And then it gets nothing. And he goes, you're the one that's confused. I was like, David, just take it back a few seconds. We have to relive this cringy moment. Oh, God. Oh, I just love it. And then Milo, of course, is unintimidated by this stuff. So he's just having fun. But just right before that moment. Oh, I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If I can't produce a chart.
All I know is this. I have one quick question. I'm not a journalist, and I may just be an old spy, but you were talking about confusion. Were we talking about you?
What?
Because you sound very confused. You were talking about people being confused about their sexuality, the
position
of the world.
No, I'm
you know, I mean, I've been to Port Said in Naples, and you look like you've been there a few times. But because
no
you
idea
seem to
means.
Be very confused
you're
about who you are and what you are.
You're the one pulling your wallet out, sweetheart.
Yeah, that's all right, shipmate.
Oh. No, I'm okay.
See, do you always have to fight with everybody?
I don't.
Pause it for a second. This actually kind of bugs me. This bugs me about Bill Maher. He then turns to Milo and goes, do you always have to fight with everybody? I mean, what are you supposed to do once someone goes, hey, speaking of confused, how about you? I would have recognized you go down an old port. By the way, I don't know what the fuck he was saying.
No
either.
Idea.
I assume, by the way, I'm assuming it was a kind of anti-gay joke, by the way, that by lefties could be considered kind of offensive. I'll tell you, it is so funny to me how many people reacted to this. This video by going through like, I just don't like Milo's kind of sassy, kind of in your face thing. Yeah. And you're like, you mean being a flamboyant gay dude? That's what you don't like? Lefties, by the way? That's what you're complaining about.
He's like a little bit of a douchey provocateur.
But once you go to this.
You were talking about the little joke or whatever. Something that happened before when Bill turns to Jack Kingston, he goes, how do you feel about weirdos peeing? Like he made a joke, and then what Milo said was, did you just call transgender people weirdos?
Milo's giving
that's a little rude.
No, but Milo's giving him the business, there, right? Because Milo's pausing his.
But nobody
thing,
seemed
like,
to have any, you know.
Well, that's the funny thing is that I respect that about Bill Maher. I'm sure there are people on the left who are furious about that or whatever. He doesn't give a shit, and like, I do respect that he's got those balls. But anyway, so once these guys are just getting kind of hostile and shitty with Milo, so then here we go. Let's keep playing.
But you always invite such awful people on your show.
These are not...
They're so stupid.
Look at...
No, come on. You need to start inviting higher IQ guests, or this
I'm
is going to be a disaster.
First of all,
wait. These are very
wait,
high.
Wait, hold on, Bill. You can go fuck yourself, all right?
Yeah.
If this is the face
of
the Nazis,
your argument is that these people are stupid. You didn't hear a word this man said early in this segment because he can talk circles around your pathetic,
this guy.
Douchey little ass for me. And one last thing, and I'll let you defend it. Leslie Jones is not barely literate. Go fuck yourself again for that
one.
Oh,
Rita Twitterfee, she can barely spell.
She's a very thoughtful person and very
woman,
funny.
Excuse me. Okay. She can barely spell.
Larry, I'm a great fan of yours, man.
I'm a fan of yours.
We are all about the First Amendment here in Milo. Yeah. Go for it, brother, because I think what they did to you in Berkeley was atrocious.
Wow, talk about strange bedfellows.
All right, we can pause there. So this is the moment, everybody. And, of course, it reminds me again, just like the Jim Jeffries thing that we played the other week. All I see, liberal sites, fucking
smashed,
Wilmore eviscerates
down.
Milo.
Yeah.
Like, he abandoned any argument and goes, hey, you know what, man? Fuck you. And then it's like this celebration. Like, you just, you know what? And he couldn't even come up, like, I don't even respect the comedic thing. Like, he's not even coming up with good adjectives. You know what I mean? He's like sitting there like kind of, sit there with your little douchey ass.
Yeah.
Like, what? Okay. I don't know how he said, how do you, I think it's a completely reasonable response when someone goes, oh yeah, speaking of confused, were you talking about you? And then you just turn to Bill Maher and go, Bill, you're going to have to invite higher IQ people onto your show. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I think that's reasonable. It was a right-on response to it was literally an insult out of third grade.
Mm-hmm.
But in a third grade set class, you go, ah, that was kind of a weak diss. You try to bring that shit to fucking Miss Barnett's class, you're going to lose your peanut butter sandwich. Anyway, we used to diss in the third grade, okay. Not Miss Barnett. That was my teacher. Anyway, the point is, it was very surprising to me how some people took this and how some people – so this is – anyway, all right. So basically what happens is everybody tries to silence Milo. And then, you know, they try to shut him down at UC Berkeley. They try to, you know, Sarah Silverman's trying to shut down his book and with Judd Apatow and all these other maniacs. And that doesn't work. None of that's really working because he's just getting more and more popular. You know, you kick him off Twitter, then his YouTube numbers go up or whatever. You know, they ban him from UC Berkeley. Then he goes on to Real Time. So none of this shit is really working. He still has a voice and a platform. So then I guess the last thing is then we'll try to, you know, they're like, some lefties are starting to realize, okay, like this is how I kind of break them up. There's the left-wing people who are like, oh, Milo should be shut down. He's a Nazi. And then, of course, the rest of us all have a lot of fun with like, oh, really? He's a gay Jewish immigrant. So Nazi doesn't really work. But then there's the people on the left who are like, no, the more reasonable ones who are starting. Maybe the ones I was saying we should keep talking to on the Tom Woods show. But the ones who are like, no, we can't shut Milo down. We have to go and win the debate against him, right? And I think what you might have realized or gotten a little bit of a glimpse into in this Bill Maher thing is that it's not that easy to just go win a debate with Milo. And I think a lot of you guys on the left can't do it. And you're going to end up just going and doing this and basically saying, fuck you. You know, look, whether Milo is completely right, I know a lot of people jumped on him about that about throwing out the thing that transgendered people are more likely to be involved in sexual assault. Like, to be honest, the only studies I've ever seen on that is that I've seen that transgendered people are more likely to have been sexually assaulted.
Yeah, maybe.
So I don't actually know what he was implying there that might be not true or whatever. But the idea that he's coming on and go, look, he's not people. We need to come to our senses here. He's not going on talking about how I think there's some people who should be gassed. He's not going on saying the Holocaust never happened or slavery was a good thing. He's not advocating for a war that we don't need to fight. He's going on there and saying, I think transgendered people are a little weird.
Yeah.
And shouldn't be let in the bathroom with other people.
Men that are confused about their sexual identity shouldn't go in a bathroom with children.
He's not saying anything that outrageous. And then the fact that he's not, like, it's so funny to me. It's that he's taking all this stuff that's been going on the left forever. Like, they could just be kind of like a flamboyant gay guy on the left who could just, you know, speak in these kind of provocateur kind of style of language where they're just kind of, you know, if you were to say something about the thing where he said about Leslie Jones can't read or write or she's illiterate. He's basically saying that, like, there's a bunch of misspellings in her Twitter and making fun of her for having misspellings in her Twitter. Now, do you think if some left-wing flamboyant gay dude were to be like, George W. Bush can't even speak, honey, anyone on the left would have been like, oh my God, that is outrageous. Yes, he can speak. No. They wouldn't care. But now all of a sudden, if you're over here and you're just being this you know, kind of provocative over the time. So whatever. As people, I'm not going to defend the letter of everything that he says, but I'll tell you the grossest thing here is everybody defending this CIA guy.
Yeah.
For fucking his bullshit work.
Well, it seems like the people that are defending the CIA guy, like those kinds of people, the people that are applauding and cheering and all that stuff, it's like they don't have any... They don't. They take everything he says like super literally, you know. Yeah. Like you were saying. I mean, it's just like he's saying, like, yeah, she's illiterate, you know.
Like, well, it's, I just again, it's like I mean, this is probably the most consistent theme that I harp on all the time when I talk about the left. But it's just very strange to me, like, where their morals lie, where their outrage lies, where all the, like it's so if there, you got one guy who comes on here who used to work for the CIA, one guy who comes on here who works for Breitbart. And they actually go, oh my God, I can't believe you would work for Breitbart, that horrible organization. And it's like, he worked for the CIA. I mean, they got caught. They, like, I know there, like I said, there's younger people who, you know, in the Obama administration, I guess since no one really cares about murdering poor brown people with sky robots anymore, there was no real CIA, you know, big controversies that were out there, like, that the press actually gave a shit about. I mean, sure, it came out that they were spying on the Senate Intelligence Committee and spying on other allied world leaders and, you know, the whole drone war thing. There was a lot of shit. But it wasn't like these big scandals out there in the press. But the administration, just before that, there were these big scandals that were out there in the press, the CIA. Like, I know Breitbart gave a voice to the alt-right, right? This is their big accusation that, like, but their website became a playpen for the alt-right. Okay, well, what the CIA got caught doing was almost as bad as having a playpen for the alt-right. They got caught torturing people and lying us into an unnecessary war, you know, where hundreds of thousands of people died and millions were displaced. And all that stuff that I keep going on about every week. But it's really amazing. You could just, you know, like, but him, it's not even questioned. It's just like, well, he was doing good work over there. You questioned whether or not we should praise transgendered people. And, like, again, I don't really give a shit. I mean, all this bathroom stuff, I just can't even pretend. I mean, of all the issues we have, guys, I can't even pretend this is one of them. Obviously... private property solves all these problems. You can do whatever the fuck you want on your own. Build however many bathrooms you want to, you know, and then people can decide whether or not they're comfortable coming to your business. But
yeah,
the idea that you can't, there's like, it's like the left sets up these holy grails that you can't, these third rails that you can't speak of. And then if you talk about them, you're like horrible. And it's not as if the left wants to shut up about this. It's not as if the left goes like, oh, we want to shut up about transgender people. Let's just not talk about it. And we're going to be angry if you say anything about it. They want to talk about it all day long. And you can't say anything other than what is the approved opinion. It is that, like, with South Park, you know, hit on the head, where it's like Caitlyn Jenner. She's, what do they say? Brave?
Was yeah, it? Brave and courageous.
Courageous and brave. Brave yeah. and courageous. And you're just like, what? Or maybe she's not courageous. Ah, is it, you know, it's that's what it is. They want to tell you all the time. So they're you know, I don't even know, man. I don't know if you know, transgendered people are suffering from an identity disorder or if it's completely normal and well-adjusted to be transgender. I don't even know if there is such thing as an identity disorder or well-adjusted. Maybe these are just constructs that we met. Like, I don't know. I'm open to arguments, evidence, any of that stuff. But I hate this kind of, like, emotional, you know, like thing where it's like, oh, there's this there's just this thing, and if you say it, then you're a bad person, and you can't even discuss. Nobody cares about context. Nobody cares about it. It's just you can't even have this conversation.
Right.
I thought there was and I don't defend Obama very much, but do you remember that there were actually – and no, there wasn't like major outrage, but some people actually got upset at Obama for using the word nigger when he was on a podcast. I forget – maybe it was on Maron's. I think it was on Mark Maron's podcast.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
And
he
said – he was talking about race relations in America. And he said something. He was like, look, like racism isn't over. People may not feel as comfortable running out in the middle of the street and yelling nigger, but there's still racism out there. Okay, this is he was making a point along those lines. And people were like, ooh, he really should have said the N-word instead of nigger. And you're like, wait, what? Like, how could there ever be better context to use the word? He's the first black president in the history of the country. And he was using the word in context, describing previous races. But, you know, it's like people just hear, oh, you're not allowed to go there. Just stay away from there. Is we want to just be children and be offended. So anyway, as I was saying before, so here's the steps, right? First, they try to shut Milo down. That didn't work. Then they try to debate him. That falls flat on its face. So then, of course, the next step is now they try to smear and ruin him. And so what's going on it now in the papers is this thing where video has surfaced. And, of course, the video that's surfaced is nothing new. And there are these old videos. One of them is like a clip from Rogan, which it's so funny, by the way, because now all of a sudden these people go back and find this video clip from Rogan and everybody's outraged. The show, I happen to know, gets millions of views every episode. So evidently millions of people saw this, and by implication, they almost have been a bunch of dummies, because I guess they weren't smart enough to realize they should be offended by this. But anyway, I haven't listened to all the clips, because there's like 7 or 8, I think, that are out now, but it's Milo talking about what I guess the people smearing him would call pedophilia, and what he would call, you know, I guess what are legally statutory rape cases, but where, you know, cases where teenagers are hooking up with people in their 20s. And this is what he was talking about. And Milo said something on the Rogan podcast along the lines of like a 25-year-old hooking up with a 14-year-old or something like that. And he goes, oh, the 14-year-old should be so lucky. And then he was like, oh, that's, you know, isn't, and Rogan said, well, isn't it rape if it's a 14-year-old? And Milo said, when I was 14, it sure wasn't, because I was the one doing the seducing. And he was basically, I heard him on this other podcast where he was kind of making the point that for a lot of like the 15-year-old guy who fucks the 25-year-old hot teacher, that a lot of times that 15-year-old guy is being the predator, if anything, and he's the one who's kind of going like, eh, watch, I'm going to go get the teacher. And then he goes on a mission to get her, and she ends up falling in love with him. And it's like, oh, we look at it like she raped him is fairly misleading. And anyway, there were a few things he said in there that made me a little like queasy, where I was like, I don't know about that. Like, he was talking about, you know, he was saying like in the gay community, this is pretty much known that a lot of times gay teenagers will go hook up with older men and stuff like
well,
that.
Well, yeah, I think he made a point where like he was saying that basically it could be a confusing time when, you know, once you've reached puberty, you're going through puberty, whatever, it could be a confusing time. And then you can have someone who's older who can kind of like show you some compassion, because if you're at home and your parents, you know, it's tough, you know, your friends don't understand, or your parents don't understand, or maybe they don't approve. So he was saying that you know, that like maybe an older person could come in, or an older man in his case, and kind of guide you and help you and show you with like love and compassion. And that doesn't sound, you know, too terrible. You know, I mean, I think it's a confusing time for all kids when they're coming of age and they're learning, you know, their sexuality and stuff like that. And we really don't get any kind of like instruction or know how to do anything. It's just like 2 14-year-olds trying to make out with each other and grab a boob or something.
Yeah.
So for him.
Well, anyway, if nothing else, I guess the thing to me is that it wasn't as if he was saying something like outrageously horrible. He wasn't defending pedophilia. I mean, he was talking about a subject that is very taboo, very uncomfortable to talk about. But that, to be fair, we do brush under the rug as a society, and there probably is more of a conversation to be had there. And truthfully speaking, like, you know, I guess what I'm saying, my big problem with it is that they basically want to go, so this guy comes in, it's like Milo's got, he's talking about political ideas, he's challenging the left, he's also putting forward some ideas that I very much disagree with, okay? But that being said, he's out there, he's engaging all these people, he's getting people excited, and then it's like, oh, no, you gotta go away. First it's like, you gotta shut up, and now it's like, we found a tape of you. So he's already, basically the big controversy is that he's been disinvited to CPAC. See, and this is where, you know, I'll as much as I rip them, the alt-right has a very strong argument, and people who support Trump have a very strong argument with this whole conservative thing, where they go, so you guys are basically just as bad. So now this guy has to go away. He can't present any of his ideas. He can't, you know what I mean? Like, he can't be heard from. Any of the other points that he makes, you can't hear. You know, so any of these provocateur-type people. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of these people like Milo and you know, someone who I've read more of her work, and I think is, you know, I almost don't want to just lump her in the same, but Ann Coulter, who I always enjoy reading her work, even though I disagree with her on a lot of stuff. Someone like Ann Coulter, who will make like 10 points, 6 of them I think are really sound, 1 of them I'm not sure about, and I've never thought about it that way, 2 I think are dead wrong, and 1 I think is dangerous. She's got to go away now because that one point you know you don't like. It's like, I can't hear the other 7 interesting points that she was making. Like, what intellectuals do you think agree with you 100% of the time? Who we're going to have no one to learn from anymore. So I hate this idea that they could just be like, oh, you talked about a no-no topic. Now you got to go away. Now you got to lose money, lose jobs, lose fans. All that shit I think is horrible. And then I guess the other topic is just once the issue gets brought up, I mean, we're so into this, you know, advanced libertarian philosophy stuff that it's like, oh, okay, so once you start talking about like what the age of consent is, that's a really fascinating conversation for libertarians. Because we're all about consent.
Right.
And what and basically I think the whole fundamental center of our philosophy is about consent, mm-hmm. whether or not people consent. We're like, you know, well, don't do things where people don't consent.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting question.
And it focuses on the individual as
now,
well.
Now, obviously, there's when you talk, right, on the individual. And this is very easy for libertarians, despite what third wave feminists might tell you. For a libertarian position, this is fairly easy when you're dealing with adults. When you're dealing with adults, it's just kind of like, yeah. Is everybody consenting? Then it's legal. If everybody's not consenting, it's illegal. As libertarians can lock it down to this is how we should organize force. Can't always tell you like what's right or wrong. That might be a more complex question, but we could certainly tell you when it's morally okay to use force and when it's not morally okay to use force. So, you know, you want to have the craziest, weirdest sex you could imagine, as long as both people are volunteering, go for it. Nobody's but if somebody's not, now with children, obviously this gets a little bit more difficult. And I think that the best libertarian answer that I've ever heard for this is kind of the idea that, you know, children have rights, but they're kind of in escrow and they haven't fully developed yet. So their rights are kind of being held by their parents, who are kind of in a trustee situation or in a fiduciary role, if you will. And then in other words, I don't think a parent should be able to be charged, say, with a crime against their child for, like, it couldn't be the same standard as a normal person, right? Like, parents initiate force against their children all the time for the child's own good. You might make them brush their teeth or something like that, or so, you know, like, make them, whatever. But as long as you are doing it within your fiduciary role and you're doing it for the child's good, then I think you have those rights kind of as a parent. If you're not doing it for the child's good, then I think it could be criminal. That would be my kind of libertarian take. Now, that being said, obviously, you know, like an 8-year-old can't consent, and obviously an 18-year-old can. But I'm not really convinced that we as a society have drawn the line at the right place. And I do think that for me personally, I think in a libertarian world, there's no question that, like, look, and this is the point Milo was making, is that he goes, you know, the way a 20-year-old looks at a 15-year-old is not the same as the way a 35-year-old looks at a 15-year-old. And if a 20-year-old wants to fuck a 15-year-old, he's not the same. He's not as despicable as a 35-year-old. Like, it really is different. I think we all know this, just as people. Of course this is true.
Yeah,
of course this is true. If you're a 20-year-old, you're only a few years removed from where it would be appropriate to date this 15-year-old. So this is the point he was making, and the idea that if a 23-year-old hooks up with a 15-year-old, this is not nearly the same thing as finding a 50-year-old abusing 5-year-old children. And I think there's something fair that libertarians should know. Now, the other thing I would say is that just it's kind of like sometimes we talk about this, whether it's with immigration or healthcare or other things, you go that in a libertarian world, we can be pretty sure that things wouldn't look like this at all. So I don't know exactly where we'd draw the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure to some degree it has to be arbitrary, and there has to be a gray area. You know, that's how this shit always works. There will be a gray area, but wherever we would draw the line, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't be saying you can choose, you know, obviously we wouldn't be choosing a ruler, but you could definitely say we're not going to be choosing a ruler at 18, but you can go fight a war at 17, but you can't,
right?
You know what I mean? Like, fucking adult. So there are all of these things where it's like, it really is pretty fucking amazing that we'll say you could do life in jail, you know, as the great Chappelle joke goes, you could do life in jail as a teenager, you can go fight in a war as a teenager, you could vote as a teenager, but if you fuck a teacher, then basically you were the victim of some horrible crime.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it's just like, what are we talking about? We're talking about, like, fucking. I mean, it's like, is there some kind of passion and love associated with that? It's like caring and sharing and kindness that's involved in that, you know, unless it's aggressive and then it's rape, you know? I mean, if it's consensual, then that's what that is. And so, you know, like, I remember, you know, for me, when I remember being in high school, I think I was 18 and my girlfriend was 15, you know, at the time. And it's like, look, like, you know, she was very, very developed and I was an adult and, you know, it's just like, officially according to law, but you know, it's like, look,
hold on, let me just check the statute of limitations. Let's talk more about that next year.
But it's like, no one's complaining, no one's up in arms, you know what I mean? Like,
I just hate the idea of like somebody having the courage to talk about an issue that's taboo, giving their take on it, and then everybody ruining that person just for having a conversation about it. So, you know, kind of, I say cheers to Milo, and maybe more people should have that conversation if it's such an uncomfortable thing. Let's dive into why it's so uncomfortable.
Exactly.
Now, speaking of, because I guess this is kind of on a similar topic, I know this is something that a lot of libertarians are talking about. Evidently, there was a libertarian gathering of some sort in Washington, D.C.
International, keyword, mm-hmm. Students for Liberty Conference.
Sounds a little globalist to me. No, I'm just kidding. That's
not nationalist. It's internationalist.
Now, I don't know. I don't have all of the details about this story exactly. I read a couple articles on it. But so evidently they are having some type of libertarian conference at like a hotel or something like that. And a hotel or a restaurant or something.
Yeah.
And they and Richard Spencer came to the event. Who I guess lives in D.C. or in that D.C. area, because this is where all his big
things keep happening. Yeah, I think he has a think tank there, National Policy Institute.
I knew that's the institute. I wasn't sure it was in D.C., but okay. Well, that's where he's always giving his speeches and getting everyone all worked up. So anyway, so Richard Spencer showed up, and there's this long video of Richard Spencer being confronted and I guess accosted, you could say, by a bunch of these people at the meeting. And
Jeffrey Tucker,
ultimately. Well, it goes on for a little bit. I watched more of the extended version in here. We were watching the shorter one out there. And then Jeffrey, like, they're harassing him, or they're kind of yelling back and forth. And then Jeffrey Tucker comes over and kind of starts yelling at him.
Well, because here's what happened. He set up a little booth in the lobby.
Did
he
though?
Yeah, it wasn't really like a booth, but it was like a makeshift. It had a sign, you know, and then there were people that were gathering around there. And from what I understood, it's like, this is kind of what he's been doing, because a lot of these people who Richard Spencer appeals to, the, you know, alt-right crowd, are kind of have been siphoning like off from libertarian events. This is kind of their strategy, because I think a lot of them were libertarians, and they're trying to convert libertarians by showing up to these events. And I think I heard about this from Julie Borowski, actually, was talking about this. And so they weren't invited there, and they were in the lobby there, and they were, you know, they were, I guess, being disruptive. And so that's when Jeffrey Tucker came in and said something for them to leave.
Yeah. Now, what Jeffrey Tucker kept saying is that if it wasn't for accommodation laws, we'd kick you out, was what I saw on the video. So I didn't actually see him kick him out. He was saying that, I guess, for some legal reason, they couldn't kick him out. So maybe they hadn't rented out the entire area or something like that. You know, I don't know exactly what the details were. I saw my friend Robbie at Reason Magazine wrote a piece about this, and he said, you know, they did kick him out, and they were well within their rights to do so. If so, I mean, if they did kick him out, and, you know, it's a private property issue, obviously, yes, they're within their rights to kick anybody out. So I would assume all libertarians would be together and saying, yes, you can ask anyone to leave your property. But I don't know if that's the end of the conversation for a libertarian. And I got to say, just in light of what's going on with all this stuff with Milo and all these other stuff, I did not like how they handled it. And at least I say this a little bit with a little bit of hesitation, a little bit reluctantly, because I don't know all of the information. And there's a lot of things there's nuance to this story, it sounds like to me, and the nuance could almost make the difference. It's a little weird to just set up your own booth, but what I saw in the video was kind of him just sitting at a table talking to other people.
Like a makeshift.
And
kind
yeah,
of thing.
It's like,
yeah.
So if he's just doing that. You know, now, are you invited to these things? He goes, I was invited. And he says he was invited by someone else who was attending. Now, I just don't know what – I've been to a few of these libertarian things before, and there's somewhere I would feel very comfortable to, like – you know, if I was going to, like, Freedom Fest, I'd be like, Mike, come to Freedom Fest. I got an extra ticket or whatever. If there was no ticket, I'd just be like, come on. I wouldn't feel weird like, oh, you have to be officially invited to come. Now, if you happen to come and you're a known guy – look, I don't know. I just for me personally, what I see on the video is I see Richard Spencer, and I think this makes libertarians look very bad. But I see Richard Spencer sitting there, a bunch of people are yelling, and the video starts with one of the people who works there coming over and being like, hey guys, we gotta ask you all, keep your voice down because people are trying to enjoy their dinner. And Richard Spencer goes, hey, if any of you guys want to talk, I'm happy to talk to you. I want to keep my voice down to not disturb these other people, as the gentleman asked. So let's have a nice discussion. And then people come over and talk to him, and he seems fairly friendly to have a discussion. Again, you can find his views repugnant. I don't think they're actually half as repugnant as people make them out to be. But okay, he's kind of a troll. He kind of flirts with some Nazi jokes and stuff like that. Oh, okay, fine. You can be disgusted by it. But what I saw was, you know, when these alt-right people call libertarians social justice warriors, I always right away start going like, what are you talking about? But then I realize that I'm dealing with libertarians like, you know, Rothbard and Hoppe in my mind. And I'm dealing with, you know, the true libertarians like Tom Woods and these other guys who are, you know, the ones who are still alive today. And I'm maybe not dealing with these types as much. But it was pretty disheartening to me to just – you could tell in the way that Jeffrey Tucker was yelling at him and the people around Jeffrey Tucker – it was so social justice warrior-y. It was like they came in and just started shouting at him, and they were just kind of like you're a fascist, you're out of here. No place for you in this meeting. Now, I don't know about you guys, okay? I just have a different attitude about this, but if that was my meeting, I would be psyched that Richard Spencer came by. I would challenge him to a fucking conversation right there. Let's do this.
Well,
Let's debate it right now.
Yeah.
Look, the same thing, the problem these lefties are having with Milo, libertarians are going to have to deal with the hardcore alt-right people, which Richard Spencer Fisher's an MMA guy. I always call Richard Spencer Spencer Fisher. But anyway, like Richard Spencer. Listen, if you think his ideas are wrong, we're going to have to find a way to make a compelling case against those ideas. It can't just be this thing that we've seen out of the left, which is, my God, that's so horrible, it doesn't warrant a discussion. And I understand you have the right to kick somebody out, but I just don't understand why at a libertarian conference we would be saying, oh, you don't share the right ideas, you got to get out of here. I mean, I thought our whole thing was that we're always happy to have a battle of these ideas. If anyone's coming to convince us otherwise, I'll show you why your whole thing is nonsense.
Right.
And I mean, maybe not. Look, I recognize that Richard Spencer's a smart guy. I recognize Milo's a smart guy. I'm not saying I could just destroy him if we debated or something like that, but I got to try. That's my job. And if I can't win the argument against him, maybe I got to start taking a look at my own ideas.
Or maybe you would learn something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I love this. I posted this on my Facebook a little while ago. Daniel Dennett, said something about debating and arguing. And it's like, always come at it with, like, I want to stand in truth and I'm arguing for truth. And if you go about it that way, then you might actually gain something from the person that you're arguing against, and they might gain something from you. And I think that's a great way to go about doing stuff. And look, I mean, like, Richard Spencer. You know, he's trying to get a movement going. He's trying to get something happening. So, props to him for going and, like, hustling. And, like, people don't always follow the rules. They're not always invited to
events.
Yeah,
I don't understand how libertarians can't have this idea. Like, he was coming and trying to siphon off libertarians. Like, convince people to join his team? You mean, like, what we're doing? Like, have we got people over here? Sorry, guys. That's how it works.
Right.
What type of hypocrite would I be if I said you can't start trying to convince people to go to the other team? I mean, look... Again, like you said, we can't – there were guys, some of the people taunting him there would have made me uncomfortable that they're libertarians. I mean, there were people that are taunting him. There's one guy who when Jeffrey Tucker comes in, there's one guy with him that yells kind of a thuggy thing at him. I thought this was so strange. But one guy goes he called him like Little Jeffrey or something like that. And he goes, yo, Jeffrey got hitters with him though. Like, it was just like being like Jeffrey, which is just the weirdest thing ever to be like Jeffrey Tucker rolls with thugs. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Jeffrey Tucker at all. It's just ridiculous.
It's like wears bow ties.
So then
and scarves.
One point they're like jeering at him and stuff. They're like, hey, what's up? Can't take a punch, huh? And Richard Spencer had a great response where he's like, he goes, no, actually, I can take a punch. Like, I'm still here. That's the whole thing. I took a punch. I'm sorry. Anyway, but it's like that's what you're not only are you going to kick him out, but before you kick him out, you're going to taunt him about someone throwing a sucker punch, the most anti-libertarian thing you could do, and also just the most anti-man, just the most anti-fucking man shit you could do. A little pussy bitch move that is to throw to put a hood on, throw a sucker punch, and then run away. And then you're gonna taunt that guy? Why? Because he still has the balls. He still has the balls to come out here and show up and make his point. I don't know about you guys, man, but I respect balls. And if someone's making an argument that takes some balls, even if they're wrong, they have a right to fucking make that. In fact, that's good because that protects the rest of us to go make an argument that might be correct that takes some balls. You know, like what I always do. I don't know. The Jeffrey Tucker is somebody whose work I used to enjoy, who's kind of taken this turn to more left-leaning libertarianism. But I got to tell you, man, I really do think what I saw in that group of libertarians, and I don't care even if you could disagree with me and be like, no, I don't want Richard Spencer. I don't want an identitarian alt-right guy at a libertarian convention. I want to talk to our people about our thing. Fine. There's an argument that can be made there. I disagree with it. I disagree with it, but there's an argument that can be made there.
Wait, hold on a second. You disagree with the fact that he wasn't invited, he crashed an event, and then that Jeffrey Tucker was in the right?
Well, I don't know necessarily. Well, I was just saying what I've been saying, what I've been ranting for the whole last time. I wouldn't handle it that way. I would be thrilled that this guy, that this is going to get all this attention on us, that I could out-debate him. I could challenge him right now. Like, oh, you're here to convince people? Okay, let me show you why our ideas are
better. No, I understand.
So, by the way, just like, I don't know that he crashed, wasn't invited. It's just a little gray. I don't know if any of that's clear. No, I'm saying I don't agree with it. I'm saying there's an argument to be made. Like, no, we just want to talk to libertarians about libertarianism, kick him out. I don't agree with it. I would keep him there. But, it's your choice. It's your event. You can do what you want to. That being said, it's hard for either way. Forget that. I'm just saying that's a fair argument. What I can accept is the incessant amount of virtue signaling that was going on both in that group and in the libertarian writing about this since the event. Like, it's like, yeah, we kicked out that racist. No fascists here. So basically, everything I've been complaining about the left doing to Milo, you're doing the same thing to this guy. You're trying to make it so that you don't have this conversation, he's got to go, and then you're feeling very virtuous about yourself for not letting him talk. Because he was over the line. What exactly is that line? You understand that 90% of people think we're over that line, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I just don't know. Again, I'm not into this, you know, we shun the outcast. Let's take on that. Look, again, it's not as if I'm not even saying I would have a line where I would go, I would almost agree with this impulse. Like, that is so horrible and awful, I'm not even going to talk to you. I'm not saying I wouldn't have a line. But, like, if someone was coming to me, like, I don't know. Like, I want to debate you that, like, genocide is good or something like that. You know, like, that eugenics is, we should wipe out lower IQ people. Like, there could be something that I would just be like, this is so disgusting, I'm not even going to put this idea out there. But none of these guys have even come close to it.
Right.
That's the truth. None of them are fucking Nazis, okay? Wait for a real Nazi. None of these guys are it. And the idea that Richard Spencer is an identitarian who believes in an ethno-nationalist state, okay. That's his argument. I don't agree with it. I think it's kind of dumb based on a lot of propaganda, but whatever. I don't get what's so scary about him. I don't get why Jeffrey Tucker and libertarians like that and a lot of these guys over at Reason, why they got to pretend this guy's the big bad wolf that the left is making him out to be. They've chosen this guy who was not that relevant, okay? Really not that relevant. Richard Spencer probably didn't have any more Twitter followers than I do until Hillary Clinton started talking about him and all. Yeah. Everyone in the media made him the biggest guy in the world. He really wasn't. He wasn't like, it's just.
It's only because he owned the domain name altright.com.
That's it. He's like, he is a, you know, he's a radical. I mean, that's for sure. He's a radical thinker. But I got to tell you, I kind of like radical thinkers. And he's wrong on a lot of issues. But Jeffrey Tucker should welcome the challenge. That's my personal take.
Yeah, I mean, sure. And I understand where Jeffrey Tucker's coming from. You know, he's like, look, this is the International Students for Liberty. We gather people together and, you know, this kind of thing. I get where he's coming from. But yeah, like, if it was me, I would want to have people with, like, opposing viewpoints there. I'd want the battle of ideas to win out. I want to see a battle of ideas, man. I don't want to see people getting shut down. And I don't want to see people hitting people. Like, I think outside of the conference, some guy got punched in the face. He was all bloody.
Yeah.
They're like, get out of here, you fucking fascists. It's like,
oh, this was at the libertarian
event?
Yeah,
it's
really?
Like, well, who's being the fucking fascist? Like, you're punching people in the face. Like,
that's right. That's outrageous.
That's...
Like, anybody who's trying to come and, like, debate ideas and talk ideas, I mean, if you're in this game, I don't understand how you want to avoid that. That we all have to do that. We have to push our ideas up against other people's. Or what's the point? And I don't understand where I would be at any one of these things. And if it was the guy, look, he's seen as, at least at this point, he's seen as like the guy on like the alt-right side, or at least one of them, one of the top guys. So if it's like, if, you know, I don't know, like the you were in the fucking 60s or something like that. And like, you know, you had like Irving Kristol and Rothbard and this, you know, if I was in some, you know, some like debate or some town hall meeting and like Irving Kristol and these guys came in the 60s, or if it was today and like, you know, try to think who's like a good example of maybe like Bill Kristol or something like that.
Yeah,
or one of these
like
other
Robert
guys came
Kagan.
In. Robert Kagan, like one of these guys who's like the guy on the neocon side. I'd be psyched, like, yes, let's go expose this guy. You know, what are the big, like, you know, like the even if it was a more fringe group, like whoever, it was like the head of the Communist Party in America, who's been like all over the news lately, came in. I'd be psyched for that. We should welcome that debate. We're still on the outside. We gotta win people over. And if there's another group of people who are interested in ideas and they're arguing their ideas, let's go expose them. And if we can't expose it, see, this is the, brings me back to the Milo thing. If we can't expose them, then we got to take a look in the mirror, because then there's either one of two things are happening. Either we're slipping and we're not sharp enough in our own arguments, or we're not up to the task personally, or there's something wrong in what we believe. So one way or the other, we got to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's something wrong in what we believe, let's correct that. If we are correct, then how the fuck could we not win the argument if we have the truth on our side? All right. Let's wrap the episode there. We got the studios packed today, so I want to wrap a couple minutes early to alleviate a little bit of pressure on the rest of the group. But thanks, everybody, for listening. Fun episode. Always great to have Daniel McAdams back on the show. Hopefully we'll get him back on soon. Good work, Mike Brank. I am going to be I don't have dates and venues right now, but I'm going to be in Boston, Vegas, and L.A. coming up in the next couple months, and Austin, Texas. So a lot of fun stuff coming up in March and April. Make sure you problem children come out and see me. All right. Talk to you soon. Peace.